right. Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to another episode in Season 2 of the CoverCast podcast. This podcast is an initiative of the Cover Project and is co-hosted by myself, Penina Achaya-Laker, and my friend and colleague, John Inazu. John and I are both faculty at Washington University in St. Louis and are fellows with the Cover Project. Our hope with this podcast is to engage with Christian faculty in higher education through highlighting their scholarship, their research, teaching, and service to bridge those connections between the university, church, and society. Today, we are excited and honored to spend some time talking with Sarah Hamersmar. Sarah, welcome to the CoverCast podcast, and thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. I'm so happy to be here.
Penina, your intro gets better every time. I feel like that's just gold right now. That's awesome. Thank you for that.
It's the Holy Spirit.
And Sarah, so glad to have you here. And I want to kind of jump right in because you're a professor of public administration and international affairs, but less than anyone think you just do soft normative work like me. You actually are trained as an economist, and that's your area of expertise. So can you tell us a bit about what you do and how it fits with your teaching role?
Sure. So I am trained as an economist. I've always been interested in public assistance programs and how they work and for whom. And so my training as an economist really gave me the tools to think about incentives and to think about doing data work that is rigorous and careful. And so it was really the right training for this kind of work, but also really set me up to be able to be in an atmosphere like I am now, which is, as you said, in a Department of Public Administration and International Affairs. So what I do there is actually train future public servants, mostly master's students and some PhD students in public administration and some in international affairs, and essentially try to help them understand the role that economic analysis and statistical analysis plays in decision making in the public sector primarily, but also more broadly in, say, the nonprofit sector and so on. And so part of what I do is really work to engage students who aren't themselves primarily interested in economics and statistics to see the importance and the role of economics and statistics in the broader scope of public service.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's so important. I had to, my graduate program was in political theory, but I had to take all the stats classes. And, you know, it was good. It was good exposure to that. I always try to connect something from my past academic life in these podcasts. And the other thing that comes to mind is, as an undergraduate, I took microeconomics pass-fail, which was a mistake because I was failing it two-thirds of the way into the semester. So I think the moral here is never take a class pass-fail. But having said that, I thought micro was such an important course. It really just almost a different way to see the world and see really important basic insights. And so I imagine, especially with your students and the roles that they either have or are going to have, that some basic familiarity with these ideas becomes very important in their day-to-day.
Absolutely. And just to make a connection too, I have law students who are in a joint program. So we have a JD MPA program, Master in Public Administration. And so every year I have several students taking statistics with me who are mostly in law classes and are taking this really as a supplement to being able to think about the sort of the public piece of law and analyzing programs as they relate to legal issues. And so I've always actually found law fascinating. I was a mock trialer in high school. And so thinking about policy, I think, really overlaps quite a bit with some of the issues in law. And the other piece I'd say that really connects is thinking through the role that policies and regulations play in the lives of individual people, and not just whether things are legal or illegal, but sort of what the legal system has set up as norms and then how that plays out in some of our public systems as well.
That's fascinating. Sarah, unlike John, I enjoyed statistics when I was in college.
Good.
I really did, but I cannot tell you what exactly I thought I would be able to do with statistics if I were to keep on studying it. But I just really loved being able to make calculations, projections, I did enjoy math, but I am fascinated to hear a little bit more from you about those specific turning moments where your students have those like aha moments. You know, you talked about policy and how important that is for people to understand that, you know, policies are also are informed by statistics and economics and numbers. But yeah, are there any other like specific moments you can think back to in the classroom where you felt like a student resonated with what they were learning statistics wise?
Sure. One of my favorite sections of the statistics class that I teach is a day where we actually we talk about why knowing statistics is important for thinking about areas of policy, including legal policy, where statistics gets regularly used and abused to try to make cases, in this case, specifically legal cases. So we talk about a couple of legal cases involving drug companies and side effects. And the purpose of this is really to help the students realize that their knowledge will help them evaluate the arguments being made in the cases. So one side, the side of the pharmaceutical companies, essentially says, we tested for these side effects, but they weren't statistically significant. And so we don't need to report them on the labels and no one needs to know about them. And then the people who have experienced the side effects say, that's not true. And these side effects were covered up. And it turns out it all hinges on what you're willing to infer from the statistical analysis. The statistical analysis, for instance, finds that some people do have the side effects, but it, because of the level of uncertainty, can't reject the possibility that those are random. And so there is a higher incidence of the side effect among people who take the drug as opposed to a placebo, but it's not a big enough difference to be sure. And so statistics is really all about how sure can you be about something? And it turns out it's in the interest of different parties to have different levels of uncertainty. And in the case of a drug company, it's of interest to them to have a high level of uncertainty in the case of side effects, because it prevents them from having to really bite the bullet and admit that there's a side effect, because there's so much uncertainty that they can sort of set it aside. In most other contexts, the people doing the analysis are interested in trying to demonstrate a statistical difference to show that, for instance, something works, something accomplishes something. So having more Medicaid increases medical utilization or increases the levels of mental health among people who are covered or things like that. So most of the work I do is sort of looking for, is there a statistically demonstrable effect of a program? But in the context of some of these legal battles, it's actually an argument over something that isn't statistically demonstrable and what you do with that limited information.
No, that's a great point. And it really it demonstrates why working with lawyers and law students can always be a bit murky, because, you know, lawyers are being trained in some ways to exploit ambiguities. And part of your role as an expert is to say, let's be careful about the expertise we have. Let's be careful about the limits of claims. And ultimately, teaching lawyers that kind of humility and argument can be really important, and especially, you know, if the balance of their classes might be more normative reaching arguments, just to say, here's what data is, here are the limits of data, and here's how we can use it, and then with integrity use it in the right ways. And you're right to point to like, lots of examples of cases out there where that just hasn't happened well. I wonder, can you talk some about your specific work on food assistance and food insecurity, because I imagine this is an area where you probably naturally have some convergence of your expertise and your own faith commitments. And so how does that play out in your work and teaching in this area?
It certainly is a nice sort of mix. And so I come into my interest in research generally thinking about the vulnerable and thinking about marginalized populations and whether they're well served by public programs. And so I'm thinking about food assistance, which is now called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, seemed like a natural fit with my other interests in trying to understand whether people are being served well by programs. So my most recent work on SNAP that's in progress is actually trying to understand whether there's a link between having access to that food assistance and being able to invest in higher education. So I'm studying young adults and trying to look at whether their matriculation into higher ed, their continuity in higher ed, their completion of higher ed, is any way related to whether they are in a state where they have easier or less easy access to SNAP assistance in order to supplement their income and meet their food needs. And so I love this topic partly because it really gets at the notion of sort of a social norms and social expectations and even incentives to try to push toward higher education. We have lots of funding in the U.S. toward higher education. There's a norm, perhaps an overblown norm, about going and getting a degree. And yet, the way that our SNAP system is actually set up is it's much easier to get food assistance if you have children, if you have dependents. And once you age out of your household, but do not yet have your own dependents, you actually hit a bit of a gap in benefit availability. Mm-hmm. And so right when we want people to go get that education, to invest in their human capital, to be ready to be self-sufficient, that's right when we pull the rug out in terms of food assistance. And they'll get it back if they get dependents. And so it's a case where the economist in me says there's an incentive problem here. Mm-hmm. That seems unintentional. And so I'm interested in whether those incentives are actually playing out in reducing higher educational investments because people have to prioritize food in the short run and set aside those long run investments that we all wish that they would or could make, but we're not supporting in the way that we could.
Wow, that is, it's really fascinating to hear you share about your research, and I did not know so much about the SNAP program, but hearing from you, I'm actually intrigued, but also curious about, I would imagine there is an education aspect here where if we're talking about supplements or nutrition, I think oftentimes if you hear the word supplement, you know, your thought process, I think about like, you know, vitamins or medicine or those extra things that you have to take. But, you know, how much of your work involves you thinking about or working with these audiences to talk about food and nutrition and that the education that goes into having to, I don't know if you're having to like make a case for SNAP at all, or if people are just like bought in that like, yeah, the incentives are great, I'm going to do it.
That's a great question. Yeah. SNAP has been pretty broadly appreciated across most circles for a while, but it's been getting bigger and bigger. So after the Great Recession, the SNAP caseloads did not really recover very quickly compared to the rest of the economy. And so there has been some concern about what exactly is going on. Some argue that it's that continued underemployment that happened, that the slow recovery was extra slow on the bottom half of the income distribution. And so so the usual measures like the unemployment rate to sort of take the temperature of the economy were not really useful. Higher educated people were employed, but the less educated were still having trouble finding work. And so the program stayed large, and I think it's in that sense come to the public's attention more than in the past and come under some amount of skepticism. The SNAP program in general doesn't have work requirements, but for young adults without dependents, the people that I'm studying, it does. And so some people have suggested that those work requirements should be extended to people with children who are not subject to those work requirements now. Others have also suggested Medicaid should be subject to work requirements. So there's this sort of connection to some of the politics around work incentives that mixes with the economics. I find in most contexts, I don't have to convince people that food insecurity is an important problem, except among some economists, I need to make clear the case simply because they expect food insecurity is not distinct from poverty or just general socioeconomic disadvantage. And so what I do have to do is at times make the case that this is a unique issue and one that affects people that we might not otherwise expect to be affected. So if you look at national survey data sets, and you compare people across the income distribution, and then you look at their answers to food insecurity questions, the two things are not actually as correlated as you would expect. When I first started studying this, I thought, well, this is just another way of studying poverty. But in fact, food insecurity is somewhat of a distinct animal that we're still trying to understand. The way we measure it in the U.S. is distinct from how it's measured in developing countries. The way we measure it in the U.S. is determined by the USDA. They have set up an 18-question survey that can be condensed into smaller numbers of questions, depending on what you might be interested in. But they're essentially questions about things like, do you ever run out of food before you are going to get paid again? Or do you ever worry that your food won't last until the next time you have money to buy more? And so some of it is not, it's not necessarily capturing hunger, it's capturing an experience of insecurity. And so the wording is really important. Food insecurity in Africa, in some areas, is really about there not being food there, or about it being dangerous to try to get to food. Whereas in the U.S., the insecurity is really driven by this notion of not lack of access, but a sort of an uncertainty in the level of access at any given time that we think really wears on people. And and some of the research in behavioral economics and psychology is finding more and more that when people are stressed, they're not able to make the kinds of decisions that they otherwise would. And so when people are under stress, when they aren't sure about where the next meal is coming from, even if they have a meal today, it can still affect their ability to sort of manage the challenges of life. And so removing that insecurity can just be a matter of finding a way to smooth out their access to food and smooth out their consumption profile so that they're not, for instance, running out of money at the end of the month. And so you can imagine there are different programs that could help with that besides just additional food assistance. But those have a tendency to be politicized and hard to study. So you could think about, for instance, something that suggests that if people learn to budget in a certain way, then they would be able to make their money last longer or buy more food. But we have this bad contradiction that our cheaper food is generally less healthy in the United States. So finding a way for people to stretch their money further isn't always a healthy option. And there's also the issue of access to different types of food. I read something recently that was sort of a, the first thing that I've read that was a bit of a pushback on the concept of food deserts. So there's this concept of areas, especially in urban areas, but in others too, where there's just not access to healthy food within a reasonable radius. And what this most recent thing I read suggested was one of the challenges is even when that food becomes available, it's not the preference of the people buying the food to buy that food. And so those preferences and norms get built over time and across generations. And it's not that simple to simply offer people different food that is declared to be healthier and expect them to pursue that food instead of what they usually eat. So I think thinking about norms and context is becoming more and more important. Economists are not trained to think about context. That to me, it's like the main weakness of economics in my mind is we're not trained to think about it.
It's interesting listening to you talk because even the way in which you're making these descriptions, I am just thinking about the empathy in your voice and in your words and empathy is not what comes first to mind when I think of economists either. So I wonder how do you balance your intuitive soft skills within a discipline that might be less intuitively drawn to empathy? And maybe also here to think about Christian faith in particular, do you find that your faith emerges in some of your disciplinary discussions or does it feel more like a sidebar at times?
I think part of choosing the areas that I choose to research, kind of I've self-selected into an area where a lot of people have a fair bit of empathy, even among economists. I'll just mention, and you know, you can take what you will from it, but it's also the female dominated part of economics.
I want to ask you about that in a follow up, because that's another thing in my mind as we're talking, for sure. But go ahead.
Yeah. But I find, you know, my values as a Christian align well with the concerns of trying to see whether programs are helping people, where there's sometimes a bit of a divergence with some colleagues is I do find at times there are people who've moved into an advocacy type role where the advocacy is based on the program itself. For instance, the program of SNAP becomes their goal is for SNAP to be as large as possible. They always want more SNAP. They will always press for there to be higher benefit levels. It reminds me a little bit of how tax debates go. One person always wants higher taxes. One person always wants lower taxes. But if we're thinking reasonably, each of us should have some idea of what the optimal level of taxes should be. And then if they're currently above that, we should be pushing down. And if they're currently below that, we should be pushing up. But we don't seem to have that sort of sense that there's like a reasonable or optimal level of benefits at times. And so I get concerned when some of my research has shown that certain programs weren't accomplishing their goals. And that implies to me that those programs either need to be adjusted or removed if money is being spent and it's not improving outcomes for the targeted populations. I think that at times can be a little bit of a tension with groups whose motivation in studying the programs is actually the defense of the programs themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I consider that an important role for myself, just as trying to be a person of integrity to say, I like this program. I hoped this program was working, but I'm finding this program isn't doing what it's supposed to do. And so mm-hmm. I can't advocate for a program itself. I try to think of myself as, if I'm advocating, I'm advocating for the targeted groups for their well-being and their thriving. And if that means getting rid of this program and spending the money on something mm-hmm. else, then I want to be open to that idea. And so economists in general are supposed to sort of stay away from hardline policy prescriptions. We like to sell ourselves as describers and not prescribers. But I think much of the work we do could be seen as prescriptive. And so it's that's an area where I'm really, I'm trying to raise this issue in several conversations. I do some work on prenatal and birth outcomes, and I'm hesitantly trying to get into some conversations with people about how we frame the unborn depending on what we're studying. So there's a group of people who study policies designed to improve health outcomes by providing, say, food or medical services to pregnant women. And they care very much about the outcomes of those unborn children. And then there's another whole set of studies on abortion restrictions that look at maternal outcomes or women's outcomes, I guess I should say, in their case, and don't acknowledge the presence of an interested party, let's say, in utero. And so depending on which session you're in at the same conference, there's somebody in the utero or there's nobody in the utero.
Right.
And I've been really just this year, finally sort of pressing in and trying to have some conversations with people about why it works this way, because it seems like there's some sort of implicit advocacy going on. And I'm still piecing it together, but I will say I've been pleasantly surprised by the openness of people to have conversations about this. I thought it might be a little rougher than it is. And that to me sort of plays a role in how I think about being a Christian in academia, in that I think we can be a little too timid sometimes. And if we just put ourselves out there, it's not always so bad. It doesn't mean things can't go mm-hmm. wrong, but I've always had a good experience with being open as a Christian in academia and being willing to say that part of what motivates the issues I care about that I study is my faith. And mm-hmm. that, to me, it's at least in the classroom, I think it's really helpful for students to see their professor as a whole person who has values and mm-hmm. has their own priorities and reasons for pursuing the research they do and the kind of teaching they do. And I find also just the representation in the classroom of students knowing they have a Christian professor is something that they otherwise don't know how to find. And so I make sure that I find a way when I'm introducing myself to make that clear. And it affects things more so in some semesters than others, but often there's like one student or two students over the course of the semester for whom that sort of opens a door for them to feel comfortable having a conversation with me that they might not have with someone else.
Wow. Sarah, I could just keep listening. You've definitely covered a lot of territory here and just touched on a lot of really great ideas that show us the complexity of the work that you do, but also show just the challenges that come with working with audiences that are vulnerable for whatever reason. And I keep thinking back to what you'd mentioned a little bit ago about food deserts and just the role of, you know, culture norms. And here in St. Louis, I do some work in community engagement where we partner with local community-based organizations. And from a graphic design or communication design perspective, we try to see how we can support their initiatives since they're the closest point of contact when it comes to a lot of the audiences we want to reach. And, you know, they get to hear stories, mm-hmm. they get to have those like really honest, empathetic conversations. And one of the organizations is the St. Louis Metro Market, and they're pretty much a market on wheels. And you know, they try and take healthy food, you know, to that last mile. They take the food on a metro bus converted into a grocery store.
Wow.
But a huge part of that is, you know, teaching people about these new palates that they're about to encounter and things that might seem obvious to people about, you know, things that are green and vegetables. And that's not everyone's reality or everyone's, you know, lived experience when it comes to what you think is healthy. So a huge part mm-hmm. of that is them having to, you know, show them ways they can prepare food or cook food. And they have a cookbook just to try and elevate these different ways of cooking and supplementing their diet. So when you were talking about that, I just felt yes. I wanted to scream and say yes, yes. There are a lot of factors at play here. I don't even think I have a specific question. I just wanted to echo that. I know, John, you'd said you had a follow-up question, but just wanted to, yes, throw more light on that and say I am with you. I hear you. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Thanks. That's really encouraging to know that they're thinking about the context and not simply assuming people want the food that they're going to provide simply because it's healthy.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Well, they're not economists, right? No, I'm just kidding. I did want to go back though and return to the gender question, because it strikes me when I think about the discipline of economics and the economists I know, it's very male dominated. And so I wonder if you could reflect a bit about your own path, not only as a Christian, but also as a woman in this discipline, and maybe even fold into that too, kind of how you got into this in the first place. I imagine, especially on the front end of things, there were probably some roadblocks and impediments to this particular area of study, and how you approach that and how you think about that now. Maybe some thoughts about what's changed in the course of your career when it comes especially to gender and economics.
Yeah, I think my story for the most part is a very charmed story. I've had opportunities as an undergraduate. I got to start doing economic research with my advisor at Calvin College, Kurt Schaefer, who's an extraordinary human being. It was never suggested to me that anything about my gender would preclude the kinds of work I was interested in doing. I was a math major first, actually, and I added economics later when I figured out where I might like to use math. I certainly come in it from that sort of technical side, and I have terrible visual reasoning, so I couldn't do engineering at all. That was like the other thing people did with math. And since I was interested in politics and policy, it sort of made sense to go with economics. But I do remember visiting graduate schools. One place I visited, their cohort of first year students that were already there from the previous year, there were 12 students, 10 of whom were male, 2 of whom were female, and one of the females was American, and that American female had gone to Harvard for her undergraduate. And I definitely felt like I don't know where I would fit here. This feels kind of uncomfortable. And when mm-hmm. I looked at the kind of work being done in that department, it was also work that I didn't find as engaging or as applied and interesting as what I was hoping to do. And so the University of Wisconsin, where I went to graduate school, was a fantastic fit. There was a higher percentage, I want to say 30% women in my program, or at least in my cohort, and a lot more of a policy focus and an interest in poverty. There's an Institute for Research on Poverty there at the university. And so in a sense, I selected into areas where there are more women. And then having studied health economics over the past several years, that's really a female-dominated area. So if you go to an economics conference, if you go to a session on macroeconomics, it will mostly be men. If you go to a session on health economics, it will be mostly women. If you go on something related to children, there will be a lot of women. If you go to something related to econometric methods, there'll be mostly men. It's fascinating to see how people have sorted into the subfields. Even though the discipline has gradually become more female, the discipline of economics is behind its peers in the sense that we can't seem to get close to parity the way that other hard sciences and social sciences have or gotten close to that. And we've been our discipline has been featured in the New York Times multiple times in recent years for being an unfriendly field toward women. Something that I've found that I could relate to, so I don't feel that I've had a personal experience of severe discrimination or anything like that, but something that some a panel of women mentioned that really resonated with me was the culture of the discipline is very aggressive, and that actually, even when there's nothing particularly gendered about that, it's not as cooperative as it is competitive. And on average, women are just less interested in that sort of work atmosphere. And so there's really been a move in the last few years to try to change what we call the seminar culture, the econ seminar. So if you go to an economics department seminar, they bring in a visiting speaker to talk for, say, an hour and a half about their research. What will happen is the speaker will say the title of the paper. They may get a couple sentences in, and then people will begin to interrupt them throughout. Things like, well, are you going to take into account this and that? And they'll say, yeah, I'm going to get to that, you know, a little later. Okay. And then they'll maybe get a couple slides in, and then there'll be another interruption. And there's sort of a joke, like the smarter you are, the more you're allowed to do this, because there's a proportionality. Like if you're smart enough, you're allowed to be, a bit of a jerk, and it's put up with. And I think what we've seen in the last few years is there's finally some pressure to simply not put up with this anymore. And to recognize that the old argument that you have to be tough in order for the work to be rigorous is just false. And it's taken a lot of women reaching the higher echelons of leadership to be able to say, look, this work is just as good as everyone else's work. And it's come about through a cooperative effort and an effort where people try to help each other make their work better in a way that isn't demeaning and negative, but where the same comments essentially get made in a way that is an intent to improve the work, where if we're all working together, we don't mind the criticism in the sense that we're trying to improve the quality of the work together. Whereas that sort of intense aggressive atmosphere of one-upmanship is sort of the historic and hopefully gradually dying piece of the economics profession that we think might be the source of what we call the leaky pipeline. The women start out as economics majors, but through every step of the higher ed process and the tenure track, women just keep falling out.
That change is really encouraging to hear, and it's a great example of really humanizing a discipline. I mean, at the end of the day, we're already running up against time here. Amazingly, this happens every single time. We say it happens every single time, and it does. But I do. The last question I wanted to ask you, Sarah, you've trained and taught at some very large schools, Wisconsin, Florida, now it's Syracuse, and I think sometimes people can feel like they're lost in the sea of humanity at these schools and the sea of bureaucracy. And yet you strike me as a very hopeful and optimistic person who's excited to be doing what you're doing. So I wonder if you might maybe close us out with some thoughts or reflections on what you're most hopeful about right now. What are the opportunities you see in higher ed, and maybe in particular in the larger kinds of schools where you're familiar?
Sure. So one of the ways that higher ed has really worked for me is I've always been able to find and tap into a faith community that is connected with the university in a positive way. I'm part of something that we call the Christian Study Center movement. The University of Florida had a study center. There's one at Cornell, not far from me. And I'm on the board of the consortium of Christian Study Centers now, which is really a group of people who think about stuff very much along the lines of the Carver Project, think very much about how to positively contribute and interact and be part of the conversations at our universities. And so I've been in that context that in a sense can rub up against some traditional campus Christian ministries that can be kind of antagonistic. And so having that sort of at my back, at my disposal, people who I know think carefully and want what's good for the university and believe that the Christian understanding of life and culture can generate good discussions in a university setting, that's always been my inspiration. And I would say what I'm most optimistic about right now, and this is funny, John, this is tempered a bit by an interview I watched with you not too long ago where I think you did a bit of a reality check for me. But my my role among these Christian Study Center communities is always the role of the optimist, perhaps sometimes a bit of a caricature just because I see a fair bit of worry around me. I think our universities say that they want diversity, equity, and inclusion. Mm-hmm. And I think Christians ought to want diversity, equity, and inclusion. And in fact, the most diverse meetings I attend on my campus are prayer meetings. Mm-hmm. And it struck me during one of these meetings with seven people who were from four different countries of three or four different racial groups, gender, ethnicity, all kinds of variation. I thought, you know, there's an element of diversity and inclusion that the Christians on this campus can promote and encourage and be a part of, and in effect, add another dimension to the kinds of diversity that the university is counting. They count what they can see, and it's hard for them to know what value it has. But when we look at the faculty and staff who come to our prayer meetings, when I talk with students who didn't know that there were Christian professors around, but they have a chance to talk with me, when I've had them to my home to talk about faith and vocation questions, I've just found there's a hunger for that, that element of thinking about life that the university is simply not providing and maybe isn't sure how to provide. And what I'm optimistic about is there's an interest in it, and I've been able to essentially pitch that part of my identity, the most important part of my identity is my Christian faith, and that's a relevant identity. It's an important factor in contributing to the diversity on my campus and to representation of an important group for students of faith who they can't easily identify. And so I've really come to terms with the idea of being a very visible Christian person and not being worried about being caught somehow. And so I've sort of wait for the other shoe to drop. Something could go horribly wrong. It really could happen. I gave a graduation speech and it was very Christian in its orientation without being explicitly so. And it was well received. I think it made some people a little surprised that I would be as clear as I was in what I was saying. But I find that, you know, unless there is some area where someone is harmed, for the most part, students appreciate authenticity, even when they don't agree at all with the position that you might hold or your beliefs. They like to know who you are. And I like the idea that my students know who I am and can have interesting and fascinating conversations with me, not just when we're together in the classroom, but outside the classroom and even ex post on Facebook or wherever I might interact with them in the future. It's a real encouragement to me that my students are appreciative of that particular aspect of my identity, even when they don't share it. And so I hang my hat on that. I think it's a valuable role for Christians to be visible on their campuses.
Well, we couldn't have said that any better than you. And that's a perfect note to close out this podcast. Thank you so much, Sarah, for your time and for just all the... I feel like this is one of those podcasts where I'm going to just keep thinking about the things you've said and do some more research for myself. So John and I are really grateful for you taking the time to chat with us. And yeah, I look forward to getting a chance to meet you in person, hopefully in the not so distant future. Thank
you. That sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure, great to have you. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.